Although data gathering devices have been seen and reported in their skies, from time to time, for more than 100 generations, and small transport craft have made landings at least a dozen times in the presence of some of their people, the reports of the relatively few who have seen them are still ignored or explained away as earthly phenomena, hallucinations, or plain falsehoods, by the great majority, who have seen nothing. Anyone who is unfortunate enough to observe one of our sampling or monitoring devices, and is rash enough to report the fact, almost automatically becomes an object of public scorn or pity. No matter what his previous status may have been, his credibility, his morals and even his sanity will be questioned. There are, of course, some scientists and other thinkers, whose knowledge and reason force them to accept the statistical possibility of life, and even highly technological races exterior to the Earth. But even these usually salve their egos with the assurance that such races, if they should exist, could live only upon planets in close orbit about some remote star, and, because of the great distance, could never visit the Earth. Their astronomers know that stars in the central portion of the galaxy are far older than their own solar system, but somehow they fail to grasp the corollary fact that every technological ability now being developed upon their own planet was achieved by races on other planets, at least a few millions of years ago, and have been undergoing a continuing process of advancement and refinement ever since. Earth biologists spend days in their laboratories, analyzing bits of meteorites in the hope of finding a few molecules of the amino acids or other building blocks of life, while we, from our ships, 1,000 miles from their planet, look over their shoulders as they work. We could, if we chose, even peer through their microscopes, or read from their minds, the conclusions they are reaching. Yet they refuse even to consider the possibility that instead of being the observer, they may be the subject of observation. Even with partially controlled population growth, during the past few thousands of generations, the demand for additional planetoids has been so great that most of the planets with conditions unsuitable for the development of life have been completely disassembled to obtain new material for ship construction, and a large percentage of the interstellar debris has been collected and used for the same purpose. Since the process began in the central sphere of the galaxy, there has, as yet, been relatively little exploitation of the spiral wings, although even the Earth's moon has occasionally been mined, on a small scale, for the element titanium, which is found there in quantity, and is difficult to synthesize from other elements. The intense light emitted during the extraction process has been observed and reported by Earth astronomers, who then explained it as being due to volcanic activity or meteoritic impacts. Much of this history you already know, but a repetition of it may help you to understand the beliefs and attitudes you will find when you take up your residence on Earth. We have been decelerating for some time, and in a few minutes we will have reached our fixed position. We can then begin to examine the planet and its people directly and at close range. In the meantime, the data projector will show us some of the early efforts by Earthman to imitate the birds. They are interesting, and can be quite informative. Most of the first attempts were simply crude attempts to fly by using muscle power alone. None of these were successful, of course, and many of them would be laughable, except that the failure of each attempt was, at least, a minor tragedy in the life of those whose dreams were shattered, along with the product of their labors. There was failure after failure, yet man would not give up his determination to fly. "Birds are no better than men," he said, "and if they can do it, so can we." Almost a full generation passed in these futile attempts. We do not have all of the data, of course. Observation was intermittent and far from complete, yet it was realized by the Galactic Confederation that air flight is the first step in the achievement of space flight, and considerable interest was directed toward this planet and its fledgling people. Various types of primitive engines were beginning to be developed, and many of these were used in the continuing efforts to fly. Unfortunately, all of them had too much weight in proportion to the energy they could produce. Most of these machines were built by men who had relatively little knowledge of science, because those who had great knowledge understood the great difficulties involved, and were sure that it would never be possible. They were, therefore, not interested in making the attempt. If Earthman could not yet fly, he could at least float in the air by using huge bags of light gas to lift him. It was only a temporary compromise at best, but, for more than a generation, and long after successful flights had been made in heavier-than-air devices, a great deal of effort and ingenuity was devoted to this means of escape from the surface. It was a delicate and hazardous art. The entire assembly of gas bag, cockpit, or cabin, motors, if any, passengers and all equipment, could not weigh more than the air which they displaced. In the beginning, hydrogen gas was used because it was the lightest of the gases, and the only one which was readily obtainable. Hydrogen gas, when mixed with the oxygen of the air, becomes a most inflammable combination, and any small rip in the bag would permit such a mixture to take place. Almost all of their airships, as they called them, were eventually torn apart by heavy winds, or exploded and burned. In either case, there was usually a considerable loss of life. After numerous, and usually tragic failures, the art was almost entirely abandoned, although one or two small ships may still be seen from time to time. These ships, however, use helium which does not combine with other elements. Earthmen finally succeeded in building combustion engines which could produce enough energy per pound of weight to make machine flight possible. He also discovered, at about this time, the merits of the cambered wing. The combination made truly successful flight possible, in what came to be known as the aeroplane. The validity of the principle had been proven, and now the real development began. Both men and women made aviation history during this time, and many became the idols of their people, because of their daring and of their skill, but most of all because they proved that man could indeed fly like the birds. A research ship of the Galactic Confederation began a rather close monitoring of the Earth at this time. It was necessary to chart the rate of progress in air flight so that the beginning of space flight could be predicted, at least a few years in advance. The beginning of space flight is a very critical point in the development of any race. It usually coincides in time with the achievement of a technological potential capable of wiping out the race if it should be misdirected. New high-speed planes of many varieties were designed, built and tested. Some performed well, others failed at critical moments. Some were destined to bring fame and fortune to their pilots, while others brought only death. Nevertheless, the struggle went on constantly, to build planes that would fly faster, or higher, or farther, or would carry more payload than any plane had ever done before. The extremely competitive nature of Earthman's society spurred him on in these efforts. Many varieties of plane came into being. Some were to carry passengers, some for the transportation of freight, and some to carry explosive bombs, with which men could kill their neighbors. It was clear that the time was approaching when Earthman would no longer be content with flight within the atmospheric envelope of the planet. Having learned to fly, he now demanded a still greater medium in which to exercise his newly acquired ability. As yet, he knew nothing of the possibilities of gravity control, and so he began to look toward the form of reaction propulsion, known to him as rocketry, as the only practical and attainable means of flight in space. At first, as in his attempts to fly, there were many failures, and a few successes. Yet he persisted, learning from each failure, as well as from his successes. The ridicule and scorn with which the leading scientists greeted the plans and efforts of the rocket enthusiasts gradually subsided as the full potential of the art began to emerge into public view. As usual, in earthly affairs, the first large rockets were used as instruments of destruction, and most of those now being built are especially designed for that purpose. The present rockets, together with the nuclear warhead they are designed to carry, form a weapons system which could quickly decimate the entire population of the planet, and all the evidence we have indicates that, unless there is some intervention now, this tragic event will soon come to pass. The determination of Earthman to travel in space has not abated, however, and the projections of our study group predict that he will begin to do so very soon. As Alan's companion finished speaking, a small blue light at the base of the video screen began a rhythmic blinking. "Our navigator is signaling that we have reached our fixed position," she said, and we can begin our search for an Earth contact. We have chosen, as our first study area, a sparsely populated section of the United States known as the Great American Desert. While this may seem to be an odd place to begin our observation, the area contains a large proving ground where much of the new space-oriented technology is being tested. Although their efforts are still quite primitive, and not very successful, it is among people in this field of endeavor that we are most likely to find a person who can give us the assistance we require. We have with us two psychoanalytical experts who will assist us in the choice of an Earth contact. As soon as we have reached our fixed position over the rocket testing station, known as the White Sands Proving Ground, they'll begin to seek for, and to tune into the minds of, one after another of the men who are employed there. If they find any who conform to the general specifications, a complete mental analysis will be made. When we submit our final report, we will probably be reprimanded by the Ethics Committee of the Social Assistance Department for undue violation of personal privacy, but I know of no other way to be sure of finding someone who will be both willing and able to assist us. While the analysts are making their preliminary scan, we will discuss some of the more critical problems of the Earth races, and the means by which we might be able to assist in their solution. At present, all progress toward true civilization is blocked by the fact that warfare is still considered by many of their leaders to be a valid instrument of national or racial policy, even though it has always failed in the end. When large numbers of people, and sometimes whole nations or races, are led to adopt basic suppositions and beliefs that differ substantially from those of others, a constantly increasing friction is likely to develop between the groups. Since they have no adequate or accepted means of testing the relative merits of the opposing concepts, as they do in their physical science, the heat of emotion generated by the continuing friction may, and frequently does, lead to open warfare. The tragedy and the futility of warfare lie in the fact that it cannot determine the relative merits of the conflicting ideologies. It can only demonstrate the relative fighting abilities of the participants. No matter how violent or prolonged the war, and no matter who may be the victor, there will still have been no approach to a solution of the problems or the differences that brought about the fighting. In a few months or a few years, when the contenders have recovered somewhat from their wounds, they will be ready to fight again. The winner usually learns nothing from such encounters, and if the loser learns anything, it will only be how to avoid in the future the worst of his military errors. In every war, both sides suffer far more loss and damage than would have been incurred by either if they had accepted the principles of the other. So long as the Earth's civilization possessed only simple weapons, of limited destructive power, it could tolerate, and it managed to survive these futile acts of mass violence. Millions of innocent persons met senseless and untimely death, and hundreds of years of patient human effort were wiped out at the passing whim of one leader. Still the race, and at least some part of its culture remained, to begin again the seemingly endless struggle toward peace and security. When weapons of total destruction come into being, however, the situation changes, for no civilization and no race can survive a holocaust of the weapons now being created by the peoples of the Earth. There is now but one choice left to Earthman: his society and its culture. That choice is whether to be, or not to be. There is little doubt as to which he would choose, if he were fully aware of the alternatives between which he was choosing, and this we must, somehow, make clear to him. All evidence which we have accumulated indicates that the common citizen of the Earth has been ready for peace for some time. It is their leaders who seem to be the laggards. The disease of political or economic power seems to confuse and mislead them, although they usually manage to find logical-sounding excuses for the things which they do. For hundreds of generations Earthman has cried, "Peace, peace," and there has been no peace. Many of their most intelligent and educated men and women have dedicated their lives to the search for peace and, although it may seem utterly ridiculous, many millions have fought to the death for it, in their periodic wars, to end all wars. Still they seem unable to comprehend the simple fact that peace can never be reached through any direct approach. It is not as gold, which can be obtained by continued digging, nor is it a treasure which can be hid at once, if only one knows where to look. Peace is simply the automatically resulting byproduct of complete understanding, between man and man, between race and race, between state and state, and between all man and that all-pervading power and intelligence known to Earthmen as God. When such understanding exists, there is no need to search or to work for peace, it exists automatically. But until understanding has been achieved, no amount of effort can ever be successful. While complete understanding is still somewhat beyond the reach of Earthman, as, indeed, some phases of it are still beyond our reach, it is only to the degree in which it is approached, that man can find peace. There are certain specific steps which must be taken before general understanding can be achieved by any race or group of races. In the area of physical science, the advanced races of Earth began to take those steps several generations ago, which is why their technology moves ahead so rapidly. In the area of the social science, however, these same steps have never been taken, nor even seriously considered. The result is, as I have already mentioned, they have no social science, only social art, which cannot progress substantially or significantly because they depend upon the beliefs and attitudes of many leaders, each of which is likely to lead in a different direction, resulting in confusion and uncertainty among their followers. From time to time, efforts have been made to create international organizations capable of dealing with political and social problems, and resolving disputes among nations. As yet, none of these efforts have been truly successful, although some lowering of political tension has occasionally been achieved. Since none of the individual governments involved are willing to delegate to the organization any of their own authority or sovereignty, such bodies have never had any real power to implement their decisions and so are in fact, only advisory groups whose pronouncements can be, and usually are, ignored by those to whom they are directed. The video screen, which had been blank for some time, now came on, showing an ordinary appearing man in his early 40s, walking briskly toward a group of transport vehicles which apparently served as the motor pool for the proving ground. At the same time, the voice of one of the ship's analysts came over the intercom. "This is an individual who seems to meet our basic requirements. We will, however, require a much more extensive analysis before it will be safe to initiate an open contact. We have a problem in that the subject is planning to leave the test base soon, and ride into a nearby town. If he does, he will be in the constant company of many other persons. There will be much interlocking mental activity, and it will be quite difficult to obtain the complete and dependable readout which we must have. If we wait until he returns, he will be considerably fatigued, and his mental energy will be at a low ebb. This also would make our task more difficult, and the results less dependable. It seems advisable that we take steps to prevent the subject from leaving the area this evening, and to persuade him to return to his quarters where he will be alone, relaxed and mentally available. We are, of course, aware that the rules of the Ethics Committee forbid any overt interference with the plans or actions of any subject of observation, but in this case, where the welfare and perhaps the lives of an entire planetary race may depend upon the outcome of our mission, we may, for once, be permitted to employ the ancient, and usually invalid excuse that, the ends justify the means. The subject is approaching the motor pool to inquire of the dispatcher the departure time of the last bus to town. If we cause him to miss this bus, there will be no other way for him to leave the base, and we can easily incline him to return to his quarters. We can then complete our analysis in a relatively short time. If he proves to be suitable for contact, we will land a small sampling carrier, equipped with an observation and communication system, at a safe distance from the occupied area of the base. At the same time, we will persuade him to leave the uncomfortable heat of his quarters for a stroll in the cooler evening air, and will lead him to the sampling carrier where the contact will be made. There is an additional safeguard in this method of approach. If for any reason, our judgment of the subject's reactions should be in error and he should decide to report the contact at once, there will be no physical evidence of the event, and it will be very unlikely that any of his fellow workers will give serious attention to his report. As the communication ended, the video screen again became blank and silent. "We had better go into the communications room," Vera said, If contact is made with the Earthman, it is you who will do the talking. Part 2. The White Sands Incident. Taken from the personal diary of Daniel W. Fry, test engineer at the White Sands Proving Ground, July 4, 1950. As I attempt to record the events of the past evening, I find them so completely fantastic and so utterly incredible, that I hesitate to write of them even in my own diary. Yet they are events which did take place. They are hard facts from which I cannot escape, no matter how much I may try. They are facts which have placed upon me a burden of responsibility such as I have never had before, nor ever thought to have. Whether I was the beneficiary or the victim of these events is not yet clear, and may never be. But one thing is certain, my life will never again be the same. Because this was a holiday, I had planned to go into the nearby town of Las Cruces in the evening, to do a little mild celebrating and to view the fireworks display in the city park. The team of Aerojet engineers, with whom I worked, had left for Las Cruces in the company car earlier in the afternoon. But since the car was already crowded and since I still had a few small jobs to finish, I decided to wait and take the evening motor pool bus into town. When I consulted the dispatcher, he assured me that the evening bus will be leaving for town at 7:30 p.m., but when, after having had a quick snack at the officers' mess, I arrived to board the bus at 7:15, he calmly informed me that it had left at 7 o'clock sharp, as it always did. When I questioned him, rather heatedly, about his earlier statement that the bus will be leaving at 7:30, he vaguely remembered having said it, but could not remember why. Since there was no other way to get to town, except by walking the 24 miles, which I had no inclination to do, I found myself stranded in an almost deserted test base with nothing much to do but go back to my quarters and read. I had no fiction available, but did have a partly read textbook by James Cook, on the subject of heat transfer. Since heat transfer is one of the most important problems in the design of rocket motors, the book was of considerable interest to me, and I decided that this might be a good time for some advanced study. I was soon to learn, however, that the problems of heat transfer can become as uncomfortable physically, as they are interesting academically. The BOQ building, in which I was quartered, was a single-story frame structure. It contained a simple evaporative cooling system hopefully intended to moderate slightly the inferno that the proving ground can become during the months of July and August. Unfortunately, the system was heavily overloaded and frequently became completely inoperative. The malfunction this evening must have occurred at about 8 p.m., because by 8:30 the room was unbearably hot and stuffy. After suffering through a few more pages of Dr. Cork's treatise, I gave up and decided to go for a walk in the hope that by now, it would be cooler outside. At least there might be a little breeze. I headed first in the direction of the old static test stand, on which we were mounting our largest rocket motor for static tests. The stand is about a mile and a half from the cluster of buildings which form the nucleus of the proving ground, and the distance seemed about right for a leisurely stroll in the relatively cool evening air. About two-thirds of the way to the test stand, a small dirt road intersects the main road, goes past the rifle range, and leads off to the right toward the base of the Organ Mountains. When I had reached this point, the thought suddenly struck me that this was the only road in the entire base area that I had never been over. The road was hardly more than a pair of wheel tracks in the desert, and they wound in and out among the dunes in a rather indecisive fashion yet, on what seemed at the time to be only a sudden whim, I left the main road and began to follow the wheel tracks out into the boondocks. The sun had been down for some time, and there was very little daylight left but, in the clear air of this high desert region, the stars and the moon, or even the stars alone, usually furnish plenty of light for a comfortable hike at any time of night, unless, of course, the sky is overcast. Directly ahead of me, and just over the peaks of the Organ Mountains, an especially bright group of stars seemed to beckon to me as I walked leisurely along. I had gone about half a mile past the rifle range, when suddenly, the brightest of the stars simply went out. This immediately riveted my attention on the spot, for stars don't just stop shining, at least not in a clear sky. Something I could not see was eclipsing the light of the star, but I had no idea what it could be. An aeroplane would require less than a second to pass a given spot, and the star did not come back into sight. Also, in the silence of the desert at night, a plane could be heard much farther than it could be seen, and there was no sound at all. No weather balloons were released at night, and in any event, a weather balloon would be rising quite rapidly and so would only eclipse a star for a second or two. While these thoughts were going through my mind, another star just to the right of the first also went out and, a few seconds later, two more just below. A strange prickling sensation began to travel up and down my spine. Whatever it was that was cutting off the light of the stars was increasing rapidly in apparent size and, since the bearing remained constant, the object, whatever it might be, must be coming almost directly toward me. Finally I could see what it was, and at the same time I understood why I had not been able to see it sooner. Its color seemed to blend so well into the evening sky that, even when it was quite close, it was difficult to make out anything but the outline. As it continued to come toward me, I felt a strong inclination to run. But long experience in blasting work and later experience in rocketry had taught me that it is foolish to run from an approaching missile until you are sure of its trajectory, since there is no way to judge the trajectory of an approaching object while one is running. The object was now only a few hundred feet away. It was descending at an angle of about 45 degrees and was slowing at a rate that should bring it to a full stop at about the time it reached the ground. Somewhat reassured by its rapid deceleration, I remained where I was and watched it glide, as lightly as a bit of thistle down, floating in the breeze. About 70 feet from where I was standing, it settled to the ground without the slightest bump or jar. Except for the crackling of the brush upon which it had settled, there had been no sound at all. For what seemed like a long time, but probably was not more than a minute or two, I stared at the now motionless object as a child might stare at the rabbit which a stage magician has just pulled from his hat. I knew it was impossible, yet there it was. My years of experience in the field of rocketry has made me familiar with most of the advanced technology of aeronautics and the newly born science of astronautics. Yet the craft which had just landed had ignored all of the physical principles we had worked so hard to perfect. The operation was completely silent. No propellers churned the air, and there was no flash and roar of incandescent gas being hurled from nozzles to produce thrust. The thing had simply coasted smoothly in from the great blue yonder, or whatever it had come from, and settled gently to Earth. Before landing, it had slowed to only a few miles per hour, and yet had shown no sign of falling. Only a helicopter or a lighter than aircraft could do that, but there were no propellers or wings on this device, and the fact that the heavy bush was crushed flat beneath it, proved conclusively that this was no lighter than aircraft. Whatever it was, it had demonstrated its complete contempt for Sir Isaac Newton's best known law. Obviously, the intelligence and the technology that had designed and built this vehicle had found the answers to a number of questions which even our most advanced physicists have not yet learned to ask. Suddenly I realized that, while all this was going through my mind, I had been approaching the craft, in spite of my reason and instinct, both of which shouted that I should be putting as much space as possible between myself and this unknown, and therefore unpredictable device. Like most of those who have devoted their lives to research, I have always been afflicted with an oversized bump of curiosity, and when the object of that curiosity is an important advance in scientific knowledge or technological ability, the curiosity becomes an irresistible force which sweeps all reason and caution out of its path. I approached the craft very slowly until I was within a few feet, and then paused to watch and listen for any sign of life, or any sound that might come from within. There was neither. After several minutes of expectant waiting, I began to circle slowly about the craft so that I could examine it more completely. It was, as it had appeared from the air, a spheroid, considerably flattened at the top and bottom. The vertical dimension was about 16 feet, and the horizontal dimension about 30 feet at the widest point, which was about 7 feet from the ground. Its curvature was such that, if viewed from directly below, it might appear to be saucer-shaped, but actually it was more nearly like a soup bowl inverted over a sauce dish. The dark blue tint which it had seemed to have when in the air, was gone now, and the surface appeared to be of highly polished metal, silvery in color, but with a slight violet sheen. I walked completely around the thing without seeing any sign of doors, windows or even seams. If there are people inside this thing, I thought, they must get in through the top or bottom. I paused then, to consider what I should do next. Should I return to the base and report the arrival of this strange new device?